for this June the 8th. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your Tuesday headlines. The infrastructure talks between the president and Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito, they have ended. Details just ahead. Meanwhile, Senate investigators have outlined a series of intelligence and communication failures that led to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, part of a new bipartisan report. The CEO of the Atlanta-based Colonial Pipeline telling Congress that Russian-based hackers known as DarkSide had infiltrated the company's IT systems, and he apologized for the incident. Meanwhile, there was a massive internet outage that knocked out temporarily Amazon, CNN.com, the New York Times website, and many others. We'll get the details from the reporter who first broke that story. He explains what happened. Vice President Kamala Harris in Mexico today, the second stop on her three-day trip to the region, looking at the rise of illegal immigration in our country. An interview with NBC News is also getting a lot of attention tonight. And President Biden departing tomorrow for his first international trip since taking office. It is an eight-day visit to England, Brussels, and Switzerland. There's a summit that will take place next week with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Just some of the stories shaping Washington today. It's ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We want to begin with a developing story this evening. Those bipartisan infrastructure talks between President Joe Biden and West Virginia Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito. Those negotiations are now over. The White House saying the focus will shift to a bipartisan group of 20 senators. Nicholas Wu covers Congress for Politico.com. I asked him what happened.
The collapse of these talks was really it wasn't an entirely unexpected outcome. I mean, they were still hundreds of billions of dollars apart, and you know, there were concessions that both sides didn't want to make here. I mean, Republicans wanted to repurpose unused coronavirus relief funds, which was a red line for the Biden administration. And the Biden administration just wanted to spend more money than Republicans were willing to let go. So with all that in mind, you know, the White House is now shifting its attention towards a different group of senators, this moderate group of 20 senators, 10 from each party, that are trying to prep their own infrastructure compromise.
But is there any sense that the outcome would be different? Are Republicans ready to negotiate with the Democrats? Can this be a bipartisan bill?
You know, the possibility is always there. The bipartisan group is currently trying to coalesce around a around $900 billion proposal, but they're not quite there yet. But you know, if past precedent is to be believed, I mean, sometimes these bipartisan groups do actually come up with a compromise that then can pass the whole Senate. And you know, the number of people in that group is not a coincidence either. I mean, you'll need at least 10 Republicans on board to break a filibuster if that is the route that they choose to go with this legislation.
In a statement issued late this afternoon by Press Secretary Jen Psaki, she said, quote, from day one, the president has been clear that he has two red lines. He will not raise taxes on Americans who make under $400,000, and he will not accept inaction as the outcome. So what do you read into that?
Well, those are the main issues that the Biden administration has really hammered home from the beginning. I mean, these were the president's promises, that, you know, even on the campaign trail, that would not raise taxes on Americans earning below that income level. And so this is still going to make it hard to get some sort of deal with Republicans, because Republicans want some way to pay for all of this new spending. And you know, to a certain degree, that will probably involve some kind of tax increase.
And finally, it sounds as if it was a relatively brief conversation between the president and Senator Shelley Moore Capito. Only about 5 minutes, correct?
Right. That's what the senator said.
More details at Politico.com. Nicholas Wu on a very busy evening. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now to the Senate, with today's release of a bipartisan investigation into the deadly January 6th insurrection. The report found security and intelligence failures at every level of government that led to the breach of the Capitol by a group of protesters. Those protesters who were supporting President Trump, coming as lawmakers, were in a joint session certifying the results of the 2020 election. Now, the report is the product of a five-month inquiry by the Senate Homeland Security and the Senate Rules Committee. The two committees found significant breakdowns ranging from federal intelligence agencies failing to warn of a potential for violence to a lack of planning and preparation by U.S. Capitol Police. And the study says there was no overall operational or staffing plan for that day, calling it, quote, a total failure of leadership. Now, in statements by some of those committee members, including Ohio Republican Senator Rob Portman, quote, the January 6th attack on the Capitol was an attack on democracy itself. Today's joint bipartisan congressional oversight report from these two committees details the security and intelligence failures in the days leading up to the attack, the lack of preparedness at the Capitol, and the slow response as the attack unfolded. And the chair of the Senate Committee on Rules is Minnesota Democrat Senator Amy Klobuchar. She says, quote, this report lays out necessary reforms, including passing a law to change Capitol Police Board procedures and improving intelligence sharing. I will work with my colleagues on both sides of the aisle to implement the recommendations in this report that are needed to protect the Capitol and, in turn, our nation. Elena Treen covers Congress for Axios.com, and late this afternoon, we spoke with her from the Senate Press Gallery, and my first question was the overall tone and language in this Senate report.
The language, I'd say, Steve, is pretty damning. And, you know, the report, it's 127 pages, and it mainly just walks through the series of failures on behalf of U.S. Capitol Police by different U.S. intelligence agencies like the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, Justice Department, and failing to adequately prepare for January 6th, but also failing to share some of the intelligence that they had received weeks, you know, some as early as December, regarding what happened. And I spoke with some of the senators who helped put this committee together, the Democratic chairman of the Senate Homeland Security and Rules Committees, as well as their ranking Republican members. And they made very clear that they were kind of shocked by the series of missteps in the lead up to January 6th. And they offered a series of recommendations to help strengthen, the ill-preparedness of a lot of the Capitol Police and other officers. I think that they were kind of stunned by what they found. And you can see that in the language that they used throughout the report.
And as you point out, using your words, worth noting that Department of Homeland Security, FBI, and the Justice Department did not fully comply with the committee's requests. My question is why?
Great question. I had asked the senators this after reading the report. They said that essentially that they weren't giving as much information, not as much as they were withholding, but they weren't cooperating as much. There's still a series of documents and questions and people that they want to interview at the agencies that they were unsuccessful in getting, and they want to continue to find answers. And I think that is really worth noting that, these key senators asked for all of this information and haven't been successful in getting a lot of it from the FBI, DHS, and DOJ. And so I think they're going to continue pushing for it. I think it's why a lot of Democrats are still saying that they think some separate investigation or a commission like the 9/11 style commission that recently failed in the Senate, why something like that is necessary to get far more answers on this, that so far, a lot of these agencies aren't as willing or having been as helpful in giving.
And so the report really looking into what happened, but not examining the origins, the why, correct?
Correct. Yes. So, and we point this out that it was limited in scope, and that's kind of how the senators framed it. It did not, attempt to examine the origins or the motivations of the people who participated in the attack on January 6th. It did not analyze the former president, President Trump's potential role, He had a Save America rally that many of his supporters who were involved in the mob attended and flew into D.C. for. So it didn't look into any of that. And I asked about this, and I just spoke with Senator Roy Blunt, and he essentially said that part of the reason they didn't go into the motivations is because the Justice Department, at the time of them compiling all of this evidence, was still identifying those who were involved that day and pressing criminal charges against them. He also said that they felt that the scope that they decided to move forward with allowed them to move as quickly as possible to assemble some of the information about the failures to defend the Capitol. And so they didn't go into that. And again, I think that a lot of people, including many lawmakers, think that they do need to still look at the motivations. They do still need to figure out how involved was the White House, the Trump administration, you know, intentionally or not, in what happened on January 6th.
We are talking with Elena Treen in the report by the Senate Homeland Security and Rules Committee looking at the events on January 6th. What about recommendations moving forward?
So they had a series of recommendations. They had 20 bipartisan recommendations from both of the committees. One was to create a department-wide plan for Capitol Police to create threat assessments for special events. You know, again, pretty stunning that there wasn't one that was created for January 6th, just given that everyone knew there was going to be some sort of threat surrounding the counting and certification of the Electoral College votes. They said that Congress, they should look at appropriating more money for U.S. Capitol Police for adequate funding for training and protective equipment, things that they don't think that police officers had that day. One thing that the senators noted in my discussions with them right before the report came out was that they couldn't believe that the Capitol Police Chief doesn't have unilateral authority to request National Guard support amid some sort of attack. And that's why, you know, a huge thing on January 6th is, why isn't the National Guard coming in yet? Why aren't they here? And part of that is because the Capitol Police Chief did not have the authority to call in the National Guard. So that's something that they recommend is changed. They think that intelligence agencies should be required to report domestic terrorism data to Congress. That's not something that, you know, is mandated. They do that on occasion, and they have briefings. But, you know, in this instance, they very much thought, especially as it relates to Congress itself, that they should be getting and receiving data on potential acts of terrorism against the Capitol. And really just looking at clarifying chain of commands and preventing delays and bureaucracy and helping get some of the help needed in real time and quickly, so that people like the National Guard, other police agencies could have came in and offered more support during the attack.
More details at Axios.com. Elena Treen, she's on Capitol Hill this Tuesday. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on, Steve.
In other news, during a Senate hearing today, the chief executive of the Colonial Pipeline Company, facing a lot of questions regarding his company's handling of a ransomware attack that essentially shut off fuel access to much of the eastern seaboard last month. In his first remarks to Congress since the breach, he cast the company as a victim of forces beyond its control, noting that being extorted by criminals is not a position any company wants to be in, and defending the decision to shut off the pipeline access, as well as agreeing to pay more than $4 million in ransom to the Russian criminal group known as the Dark Side. Now, hackers were able to gain access to the company's network through an account that was not protected with multi-factor authentication. Rather, that account was protected by a single password. Here's more with the testimony of CEO Joseph Blount.
The safety and security of our pipeline system is something we take very seriously, and we always operate with the interests of our customers, shippers, and country first in mind. Just 1 month ago, we were the victims of a ransomware attack by a cyber criminal group, and that attack encrypted our IT systems. Although the investigation is still ongoing, and we believe the attacker exploited the legacy VPN profile that was not intended to be in use, DarkSide demanded a financial payment in exchange for a key to unlock the impacted systems. We had cyber defenses in place, but the unfortunate reality is that those defenses were compromised. The attack forced us to make difficult choices in real time that no company ever wants to face. But I am proud of the way our people reacted quickly to isolate and contain the attack so that we could get the pipeline back up and running safely. I am also very grateful for the immediate and sustained support of law enforcement and federal authorities, including the White House. We reached out to federal authorities within hours of the attack, and they have continued to be true allies as we've worked to quickly and safely restore our operations. I especially want to thank the Department of Justice and the FBI for their leadership and the progress they announced earlier this week. I also want to express my gratitude to the employees of Colonial Pipeline and the American people for your actions and support as we responded to the attack and dealt with the disruption that it caused. We are deeply sorry for the impact that this attack had. But we are also heartened by the resilience of our country and of our company. Finally, I want to address two additional issues that I know are on your minds, and I'm going to address them the only way I know how, directly and honestly. First, the ransom payment. I made the decision to pay, and I made the decision to keep the information about the payment as confidential as possible. It was the hardest decision I've made in my 39 years in the energy industry, and I know how critical our pipeline is to the country, and I put the interests of the country first. I kept the information closely held because we were concerned about operational safety and security, and we wanted to stay focused on getting the pipeline back up and running. I believe with all my heart it was the right choice to make, but I want to respect those who see this issue differently. I also now state publicly that we quietly and quickly worked with the law enforcement in this matter from the start, which may have helped lead to the substantial recovery of funds announced by the DOJ this week.
Joseph Blount is the CEO of Colonial Pipeline before the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Now, the hearing focusing on the company's preparedness and response, once again putting the spotlight on cybersecurity. Companies like Colonial playing key roles within our nation's economic infrastructure, and Congress, we should point out, now looking at some possible new regulation that would prevent these type of attacks from occurring. More from today's hearing. Here's Michigan Senator Democrat Gary Peters, a member of the committee.
Well, as you mentioned in your opening comments, and you've reiterated here in answers to these questions, you've been working closely with the FBI, and I know you allowed Mandiant, the private security firm, which you also referenced in your opening, to share information with CISA, and that is happening now. But given those actions, I would suspect that you agree that you have a responsibility to protect other potential victims. Based on what you have learned, to what extent do you believe that responsibility extends?
Thank you for that question, Mr. Chairman. We've been very transparent from the start. If you looked at who we contacted that day, we started with the FBI. Obviously, they included in the follow-up conversation. And then we started marching through all the ones that we normally would report to, whether it's the FERC, PHMSA, DOE, et cetera, et cetera. And what we found during that day was that we were allowed the conduit through DOE to talk to all these organizations on an ongoing basis, but through one central briefing. So we found that the ability to have that conduit to work on the supply side of the equation and on the restoration side of the equation with any number of governmental entities was extremely helpful to us. And then, of course, on the investigative side, we had the FBI and CISA working on that. So for anybody that comes under an attack like this, what you can't recreate is time and space and the ability to respond. And so the ability to have the conduit both on the investigative side as well as on the restoration and on the supply side was extremely helpful to Colonial Pipeline and our employees. It was an all-hands-on-deck situation that morning and throughout the event.
The head of Colonial Pipeline from today's Senate Homeland Security hearing. It's available on our website at cspan.org. And we take an in-depth look at the cyber threats on our podcast, The Weekly. Our guest is former Defense Secretary, former CIA Director Leon Panetta, a reminder of how connected and dependent we are in our computer technology society.
Yeah, there's no question that we are becoming increasingly digitalized. I mean, we are computer expanding our computer capabilities across the board, where businesses now are basically putting their entire business dependent on computers and artificial intelligence capabilities that can basically run businesses on their own. The more we become dependent on these computers to run vital infrastructure in this country, the more vulnerable we are to those cyber attackers who are going to try to do what they can to basically interfere and capture those computers. That is the vicious circle that we are now locked into.
Be sure to listen to the full interview with Leon Panetta on our podcast, The Weekly, available wherever you get your favorite podcast. Meanwhile, dozens of websites went down briefly around the world today, including CNN.com and The New York Times, after an outage at a cloud computing service, again illustrating just how vital a small number of behind-the-scenes companies have become in running the Internet. The sites also including Amazon, The Financial Times, and The London Guardian. Tim Darnell of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, one of the first to break the story this morning. We spoke with him this afternoon, and my first question, what happened and why?
What happened is that on Tuesday morning, June 8th, around 6:08 a.m., our content producer, lead editor, Mr. Rich Barrett, noticed that some major websites were reporting outages. Now, these websites included the New York Times, the Guardian, CNN, several others. Great Britain's homepage went down shortly around, probably close to 6:15 a.m. Eastern Time. We went online with the story around 6:20, and I think we were one of the very first news outlets to report it. What happened is that a company based in San Francisco, known as Fastly, this is a content delivery network that provides some very vital but also very behind-the-scenes cloud computing edge servers to many of the Internet's popular sites, commonly known as cache. The servers store content such as images and video in places around the world so that people like you and I and users, millions of users across the world who use the Internet, can fetch that data more quickly. Obviously, when something like this happens, especially now with all of the recent cyber attacks that's been going on for almost coming close to 2 months now, the first thing you think of when you see an Internet outage is, oh my goodness, is this another cyber attack? Are we more victims of the Russian group of hackers known as DarkSide? In this particular instance, this was simply a technical issue. Fastly was very quick to recognize the issue and implement a fix. And that happened shortly after 7 a.m., soon thereafter, a lot of the websites, CNN, the New York Times, all of these sites began getting back up and running. But, in an atmosphere of cyber terrorism that we're in right now, it certainly gets your attention. Whenever you see any kind of a web outage, you see a 404 page unknown graphic like we were seeing this morning, that's the first thing that pops into everyone's mind. Are we looking at another cyber attack?
And as somebody who follows these issues, another reminder of how interconnected we are, how dependent we are on websites and computer technology, and also, as you pointed out, how vulnerable we can be.
We are very vulnerable, and look at what happened only a month and a half ago here in Metro Atlanta. Colonial Pipeline, which is headquartered here, was the target of a ransomware attack to the tune of $4.4 million. The CEO of Colonial Pipeline, Joseph Blunt, testified on Capitol Hill today, and he'll do so tomorrow on Wednesday, how his company responded to the cyber attack. Yesterday, Monday, the U.S. Justice Department announced that it has recovered the majority of the ransomware, $4.4 million in cryptocurrency that Colonial Pipeline paid to DarkSite. But still, this has become a predominant issue in President Joe Biden's very young administration. Last week, the Justice Department announced that it was elevating the level of response associated with cyber terrorism, that of in-person terrorist attack. That gives you a pretty clear indication of how seriously the federal government is taking these ransomware attacks.
Tim Darnell is joining us from Atlanta. His work available at ajc.com, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Steve. Good luck.
At the closing bell, the numbers were mixed today. The Dow losing 30 points. The S&P up a fraction. The NASDAQ rose 43. You're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back to Washington Today for this Tuesday. Here are some of your COVID-19 headlines. Dr. Anthony Fauci is saying that the U.S. must vaccinate more people to keep up with the Delta variant, first identified in India, from becoming dominant here in the U.S. Now, that variant accounts for an estimated 60% of new cases in the U.K., compared to at least 6% here in the United States. And our country adding just over 16,000 new COVID-19 cases in children between late May and early June. That, by the way, is the lowest number of new child cases in nearly a year. Now, these numbers represent a nearly 52% decline from the previous week. In addition, about 64% of U.S. adults have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, and nearly 53% are fully vaccinated. We did receive some new pandemic numbers earlier today on where things stand. Dr. Rochelle Walensky is the director of the CDC with this update.
As far as the data, yesterday, CDC reported just over 10,000 new cases of COVID-19. Our seven-day average is 13,277 cases per day, and this represents yet another decrease of nearly 30% from the prior seven-day average. But most importantly, a 94% decrease from COVID-19 cases since January of this year. And the first time that the seven-day average of cases has been less than 15,000 since March 27th, 2020. In other good news, the seven-day average of new hospital admissions is just a bit over 2,200. That is a decrease of 83% in hospitalizations since January 9th of this year, when we peaked at over 16,500 average daily admissions. And finally, the seven-day average of daily deaths remains at 379 per day. It gives me so much hope to report these declines in cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. It is in part a result of our ongoing efforts to vaccinate so many Americans. Each week, there are more and more data to demonstrate the impact of vaccination has on preventing disease and moving us out of this pandemic. Today, CDC published an MMWR that demonstrates how high vaccination coverage in older adults in the United States has served to reduce COVID-19 cases and severe outcomes.
That update from the CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, and a few other additional notes on COVID-19. Andy Slavitt, the lead advisor for the White House's COVID task force, announcing that tomorrow will be his last day on the job. In Ohio, Governor Mike DeWine issuing a plea to residents to get the shot, warning that as many as 200,000 Johnson & Johnson doses are set to expire later this month on June 23rd. In Wisconsin, a pharmacist there who pleaded guilty to ruining 500 doses of COVID-19 vaccine back in December, he has been sentenced to 3 years in prison. Carnival Cruise Line announcing that the passengers will be required to be fully vaccinated when it resumes operations in July. And in a new Gallup survey, 66% of adults saying that their lives are at least somewhat back to normal more than a year after this pandemic first began. President Kamala Harris pushing back against criticism for not visiting the U.S.-Mexico border as she leads the White House effort to address a surge of migration here in the U.S. The vice president, as we said earlier, wrapping up a three-day visit, first to Guatemala, today in Mexico. During an interview with NBC News that aired this morning, Lester Holt, citing criticism of her decision not to go to the border and asked whether she has plans to visit, here is that exchange.
Okay. Do you have any plans to visit the border?
At some point, you know, we are going to the border. We've been to the border. So this whole thing about the border, we've been to the border. We've been to the border.
You haven't been to the border.
I haven't been to Europe. And I don't understand the point that you're making. I'm not discounting the importance of the border.
Well, I mentioned it because I know Republicans have certainly come at you on this, but Democratic Congressman Cuellar, as a border district, has said to you and the president, come. You need to see this.
Listen, I care about what's happening at the border. I'm in Guatemala because my focus is dealing with the root causes of migration. There may be some who think that that is not important, but it is my firm belief that if we care about what's happening at the border, we better care about the root causes and address them. And so that's what I'm doing.
The full interview is available on the NBC News website, and that with Vice President Kamala Harris, an interview that was taped yesterday in Guatemala, airing today. There has been a significant increase of migrants coming to the U.S.-Mexico border over the last couple of months. In April, Border Patrol officials encountered a record number, 178,622 migrants, which included a number of unaccompanied children, families, and single adults. As you heard from Lester Holt, Republicans have been critical of the Biden administration. And on Fox News, Representative Jody Arrington of Texas responding to that NBC News interview.
Well, I think what's political is that she and President Biden are placating the left with open border policies. And I think if she went to the border, she'd have to own that. And she doesn't want to be accountable for the cause and effect of their own policy. So it's easy just to fly over her own people and show tremendous disrespect. It is absolutely insult to injury while they're effectively bleeding out with lawlessness and chaos in along the border and in border communities in Texas and other border states. And she's paying lip service by saying, don't come to America. Meanwhile, the policies say, come one, come all. It is a free-for-all, and there's no accountability. And in fact, they are rewarding this behavior. So I think it's not a grand gesture to come to the border and prioritize your people. It's called leadership.
Fox News with Texas Republican Congressman Jody Arrington. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Tony Blinken participating in a second day of congressional hearings and a testimony initially casting some doubt on a report looking at the origins of COVID-19. It comes from a new Wall Street Journal story concluding the hypothesis of a virus leak from a Chinese lab and saying that hypothesis is plausible. The Secretary of State telling lawmakers, quote, I saw the report. I think it is on a number of levels incorrect. Now, the journal did cite people familiar with a classified government report concluding that the hypothesis of a virus leak from that Chinese lab in Wuhan was plausible and deserved further investigation. During another part of today's hearing, this line of questioning by Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina.
All right, we got a lot of problems in this world, Mr. Secretary. One of the problems I worry about is a nuclear arms race in the Mideast. Do you worry about that?
Yes.
Good answer, honest answer. Are you familiar with the fact that the United Arab Emirates has a nuclear program, but they do not enrich when it comes to their fuel supply?
Yes.
Okay, it's called the 123 agreement. It's called the gold standard. Do you support non-proliferation when it comes to nuclear programs?
I do.
Okay. Do you expect the Arabs to continue the policy of not enriching if we allow the Iranians to enrich?
I think if we allow the Iranians to get a nuclear weapon or to be on the threshold.
That's not my question. My question is, I've talked to the Arabs very recently. Whatever you give the Iranians in terms of enrichment, do you expect the Arabs to want the same capability?
The challenge, Senators, we both know when it comes to Iran is they have the knowledge, and the practice of immersion. So it's hard to compare.
But my question is, there's a better way here. What if everybody in the Mideast, the Arabs and the Iranians, could have nuclear power from an international fuel bank and nobody needed to enrich? Does that sound like a good idea?
It does, and actually I read the very thoughtful piece that you wrote recently on that, and let me just say this. I think it's a very compelling idea. Here's the challenge. We actually thought of something similar back when the JCPOA, and actually its predecessor, the interim agreement, was being negotiated. It's something that we put forward to Iran.
And the Iranians said no.
And they said no.
Well, you know, are we going to let the Iranians say no to an idea that would prevent a nuclear arms race? They say they want nuclear power for peaceful purposes. There's a way for them to have that. The UAE wants a nuclear power program. They're not insisting on enrichment because they don't want a bomb. So here's what I would suggest. Please study this idea hard and maybe not take no for an answer, because I promise you, if you allow the Iranians to go back into the deal with a robust enrichment program, any enrichment program, the Arabs are not going to sit on the sidelines and watch their mortal enemy have a capability they are lacking. And we can prevent this if the world would reunite around the idea of nuclear power, yes, nuclear weapons, no.
That with Senator Lindsey Graham and the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, earlier today on Capitol Hill. Meanwhile, President Biden leaves tomorrow morning for his first foreign trip of his presidency, attending a series of European summits. He'll be attending the meeting of the Group of Seven Nations. That will take place in Great Britain, and then he'll head to a NATO summit in Brussels. He will then sit down with the majority of the European Union leaders, and that will all be preceded by what is likely to be a tense encounter with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Geneva, Switzerland, on June 16th. Now, after spending the first 5 months of his presidency focusing on domestic affairs and the pandemic, President Biden now moving to the global stage. In today's White House briefing, a question on the summit, the eight-day European trip, to Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
Just broadly, if you could explain a little bit more how the president has been preparing for this big trip tomorrow. How much time has he been spending in briefings? Just sort of how has he been getting ready for this upcoming?
Well, first, I will say that he's been getting ready for 50 years. He has been on the world stage. He's known a number of these leaders for decades, including President Putin and including a number of the leaders he'll see at NATO and he'll see at the G7. Now, this is an important opportunity for him to see them in person, and there's nothing like face-to-face engagement in diplomacy. And for him, somebody who, as you've seen, the fact that he's welcomed in Democrats and Republicans to the Oval Office, that's just an indication of how much he feels that format is effective. So he's been engaging with his team, talking about what bilateral conversations he'll be having, where there are opportunities, where there are moments to voice the United States' concern where necessary. But again, he's got quite several decades of experience to build on here. So he'll be relying on that.
That from today's White House briefing with Press Secretary Jen Psaki. And joining us on the phone is Niall Gardner. He's a senior fellow and director of the Heritage Foundation's Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom. A lot on the president's agenda as he heads to Europe for the next 8 days. What does he need to accomplish?
Well, this is undoubtedly a very big trip for the president as he heads to the UK, also to Belgium, to Brussels, and on to Geneva to meet with Vladimir Putin. So certainly this is a high-stakes trip for the president, his first major international trip. And there's certainly, I think, a great deal to discuss on the table at different meetings, not least, of course, the growing threat posed by both China and Russia. And this is an increasingly dangerous time for the United States, for its allies on the world stage. And we are facing mounting threats from adversaries across the world, especially from Moscow and from Beijing. So it's important that the president project a clear message of strength and resolve rather than any kind of mixed messaging, any sort of appeasement message, especially in advance of his meeting with Vladimir Putin next Wednesday.
Well, let's talk about that meeting in Geneva, Switzerland, with the Russian president. How does he convey that? And will President Putin listen to President Biden?
Well, I think that President Biden needs to be a lot tougher than he has been so far on the Russian front, because some of the messages that the White House have sent towards Moscow have been rather weak-kneed, especially over the hugely controversial Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is a Russian pipeline project, which has completely divided America's European allies, and the strong opposition to the pipeline from Eastern and Central Europe. And many U.S. allies believe that the president is throwing them under the bus by actually refusing to sanction those who are involved in the building of this pipeline. So I do think that the president has to be a lot tougher towards Russia. He cannot project kind of weakness that he has done so far at Nord Stream 2. The only message that Vladimir Putin understands is real strength coming from the United States and the Western alliance, and we need that alliance to be absolutely rock solid in unity and stand up to the Russians. At the moment, it's very divided, and I have to say that President Biden has not been tough enough with regard to standing up to Putin.
Before Brussels and Geneva is the G7 summit in Cornwall, England. As a native of Great Britain, why that location? What can you tell us about the venue?
Right, so Cornwall is on the southwest coast of the United Kingdom. It's a very beautiful area. It is a perfect setting, I think, for the for the G7 summit. It also has definitely better weather, I think, than you have in London. So it is actually somewhat sort of, the location for the summit is somewhat isolated, but that, I think, is intentional, which makes it easier for all of the world leaders to be able to, to meet without facing perhaps a huge protest that one would see normally in a big city like London. But Cornwall, of course, is a very popular holiday spot for the British public. It's a very well-loved part of the country. So, I mean, it's natural that Boris Johnson has selected that beautiful part of Britain for Boris's first big, G7 summit.
And, of course, in the middle of these high-stakes meetings and summits, a meeting at Windsor Castle with Queen Elizabeth, and you wrote recently about the passing of Prince Philip. So your thoughts?
Yes, this will be, I think, a very significant meeting in many ways, because it's the first meeting that the Queen is hosting with a world leader since the passing of her husband, Prince Philip, in April. And the Queen has been incredibly resolute. She has shown tremendous strength and determination and courage since the passing of her husband. And the fact she is hosting this meeting with the U.S. president so soon after the passing of Prince Philip is a testament to her tremendous continuing dedication to the British people. At the grand age of 95, next year, the British public will celebrate 70 years of Queen Elizabeth II on the throne. That's a huge achievement. So this meeting with the U.S. president will be very, very closely watched. It would be a political meeting because the Queen does not take political positions. But certainly, I think everything that we see on Sunday in terms of the meeting between Joe Biden and the Queen is going to be very, very closely scrutinized on both sides of the Atlantic. It's also going to be, there's an element of controversy, I think, in the UK with regard to this, because Joe Biden, of course, has been a strong supporter of Irish nationalism in the past, and as a senator, he was quite sympathetic towards the Irish Republican Army. And that, of course, is a hugely unpopular position to take for the British public. And so this meeting is not without its controversy, certainly this weekend.
Niall Gardner, he serves as a senior fellow and the director of the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom. His work available at heritage.org. As always, we thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And a reminder, this program is available as a podcast. Be sure to listen and follow wherever you get your favorite podcast and all of our coverage. It's available online anytime at cspan.org. I'm Steve Scully in Washington, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.